Good evening. Excuse me, I thought I was recording, but I started playing something. There we go. Welcome. Thank you all for coming. Appreciate seeing some new faces here tonight. As Sarah said, this talk is occurring within the context of a series of talks that I've given recently on an essay written by the founder of this school of Zen Buddhism, Ehe Dogen. And the essay is difficult to pronounce, just like my Dharma name, Fukan Zazengi, which we just chanted tonight. Thank you all. The chanting was so full and wonderful, and I also understand why we don't chant it more often. I have to find a way to give an abridged version of the talk that I prepared for you tonight. It's not exactly a class, it's just a talk on the same theme, and so I hope that those of you who are new will find it accessible. I think that there's a lot in it for beginners. I'd like to begin with a quote by the Japanese Zen teacher Isho Fujita, who those of you in the class have become familiar with. He's a contemporary teacher. And he was the first Zen teacher who I sat with many years ago in Western Massachusetts, very briefly, and encountered him several years later and at San Francisco Zen Center quite fortuitously. He has written extensively about the practice of Zazen, which is the word that, for those of you who are new, which is the word we have for the style of sitting that we do in the school, which we just did before service. And so I'll begin with his words. It is certain that the practice of Zazen with nothing to gain is not a social movement that tries to bring about direct resolutions to social problems by means of that practice. Zazen is only Zazen. Nothing more and nothing less. However, if the sense of tension is lost between the practice of Zazen and the realities of society that are full of contradictions, then there is a great danger that Zazen falls into a conservative activity. We must acknowledge that in the past this very thing has happened. We mustn't simply understand the, quote, perfect nature of the present, unquote, in a bland, monotonous way, and thereby jump to the conclusion that it's all right to accept the way things are and the maintenance of the status quo on the pretext that everything is all right as it is. To accept the way things are, no matter what, is completely different than to accept and maintain the present with the secret intention to utilize it for one's own convenience. Quote, the perfection of the present moment, unquote, does not teach us to indulge in the present, nor is it to say that there is no problem either with society or with us. Regardless of your discriminations, expectations, and hopes, it is clear that it isn't possible for the present to be anything else, including all the contradictions in society, as well as your own suffering and anguish. This is related to the solemn nature of the present. So that's part of a passage that I sent out to the class and as some supplementary reading, which some of you may have gotten to. I have been talking quite a bit about the sitting practice of Zazen recently, and as well as, you know, here, as well as in a talk that I offered at San Francisco Zen Center recently. And tonight I'd like to continue a bit about Zazen, but with a wider view than I've been recently emphasizing from the Dharma seat. I want to begin by addressing something that I think is very important and is broader and more encompassing than the sitting practice alone, that in Zen we often refer to as Shikantaza, which is translated only just sitting. And pose a question: what is the difference between Zen and Zazen? Anyone have any ideas that immediately come to mind? It's okay if you're not certain, and there are many ways to respond to this question.
Zen is
Zen your life, and then sitting Zazen is just sitting? Like practicing it in your life and then sitting it and sitting.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Oscar?
Like everything else, they're different and the same. Zen is a practice, a philosophy, a school.
Zazen is just sitting. It's. I hate to say. I'm sorry to use the word, but it's a technique that we can employ. Forgive me.
Thank you. I'll take a few more. There's so much more participation than I anticipated. This is wonderful. Take a few more, and then I'll invite the rest of you during Q&A.
No different.
I hear Mary Mosine quoting Blanche Hartman, "It's all Zazen."
One more? Or not? Okay. There are some really important practical distinctions between the meaning of the words Zen, Shikantaza, and Zazen. And we use them frequently and in many ways in this school of practice, and sometimes simultaneously and sometimes in very distinctly different ways, and sometimes in mysterious ways. I think there is a little Z Zazen and a big Z Zazen. And the big Z Zazen is the it's all Zen, or it's all Zazen, rather. And it occurred to me that if we don't understand these different meanings, these distinctions, we might also not understand really very fully the two truths. In recent days, I've been wanting to articulate these two truths as three truths rather than two, or as one threefold truth. The traditional two truths are usually referred to as either the relative and the ultimate, the conventional and the ultimate, the dual and the non-dual, sameness and difference. These are all different words for referring to these truths. And the three truths that I will refer to provisionally tonight, I think, can help prevent us from seeing the two truths as either separate or capable of being kind of merged into one truth without distinction. And the reason that I'm wading into this tonight is not for a theoretical or a philosophical reason, but for the purpose of addressing what arose in me recently as a kind of ethical conundrum. It became very vivid in my mind, and it was when looking at this from the perspective of, in Zen, what we call the Bodhisattva path, or practicing for the benefit of all beings. You might say for the freedom of all beings, for their liberating awakening, our liberating awakening. So this view is much broader and more inclusive than just sitting or practicing shikantaza for our own comfort or for our own settledness or our own personal awakening in a world of suffering and myriad manifestations of greed and hostility and confusion. So that said, I want to return to the difference between Zen and Shikantaza or Zazen, which we often use simultaneously, I mean synonymously. And I think tonight I will be using Shikantaza and Zazen synonymously. I'll let you know if I use it differently. And in an effort to reveal this difference, I want to start with the two truths. As I said, the first truth is relative, which includes not only duality, which is thought of as kind of a polarity, but the multiplicity of things that Dogen called the myriad things, all differences that appear to us. This truth reflects one way of perceiving, experiencing, and relating to the world. And the second truth, this non-dual truth, refers to the essential sameness among differences. A sameness that's often conceived of as oneness, talked about as oneness, or it can imply non-discrimination among the appearances, and an understanding of a fundamental equality. We have a something we chant in our liturgy called the Sando Kai, translated in English as the harmony or the equality of sameness and difference. The non-dual is also often referred to as interdependence or interbeing. And in our everyday lives, we can learn to think in these two different ways. And in our mind's eye, we can see the world through these two lenses, you know, in terms of two truths, sameness and equality. But in the beginning, the non-dual view of sameness and equality, at least for a few years, requires some real settledness, some real deep ease in the body and mind in order to recognize or feel the truth of it. Sometimes it comes about spontaneously in one's life, but then to be able to return to it, one needs to cultivate an ability to do that at will, so to speak. Hence our practice of Shikantaza. So what is a third truth? This is provisional, and it's not something you've never heard of, and it's not even something in addition to the two truths. It's the inseparability or the harmony of the two truths, and it's the way that the two truths are completely interfused without losing their distinction. And I think of this third truth as what we often call the ultimate truth. Sometimes we say there's the relative and the ultimate, and then we equate the non-dual with the ultimate. But I think we miss something sometimes, and really what is ultimate is this interfusion, this inseparability in my mind. And if we don't think about it in this way, there's a tendency to relate to, even if we're asked, we may say, no, I don't think of it in that way, but we can tend to relate to these two truths as, you know, one being on one side and the other being kind of on the other, and one being an accomplishment and the other one being ordinary or deluded. So in our normal everyday routines, our interpersonal relationships and various beings, our joys and sorrows. In this realm of our lives, we need to make discernments and decisions. And this is not something to get over, you know, in our practice. It is the obvious truth of our human existence. And we don't practice Zen to try to dissolve that like salt in some oceanic realm of non-duality. Similarly, in our everyday lives, going about our business, we don't think that we're actively turning away from or denying the truth of oneness or sameness. We just go about our differentiated business in a kind of subject-object state of consciousness. Otherwise, it's not really possible to function safely, you know, to chop the carrots or to drive the car or to come into this room and take our seat without incurring injury or causing injury. So the point being, in our relative everyday lives, when we get up from our seats, we need to pay attention to what we're doing and to the impacts of what we're doing. When we sit down to practice shikantaza, only just sitting, many people have at least a subtle, if not a really extreme, understanding that what we're doing, at least temporarily, is turning our attention away from conventional reality, everyday life, away from the world of suffering of all kinds, our own suffering, the suffering of the world. This is a natural tendency to want to turn away. You know, to think, I'm going to the Dharma Center or to the Zendo or to the monastery for a break from all of that. You know, to get away from it. And it's understandable. And many people think and feel this way, and I think it's okay. And that it can even be helpful in the beginning, because it gets us here, you know. It gets us to our seats, to this place of practice with others, which many of us relate to at some point or ongoingly as a kind of refuge. So I want to just invite you to notice the tendency within yourself. You know, what is the tendency or the habit of mind when you come here? What motivates you to come? You know, what are you hoping to experience or take with you when you leave? Do you think that coming here is to get away from the myriad things? Or do you think that coming here is a way of turning towards something that you can enjoy and be nourished by? Or do you think you're coming here to sit down in your seat and simply be more intimate, more fully conscious of and present with whatever is inside of you? Your own suffering, including your awareness of the suffering of myriad beings. We're all seeking something, I think, or we would not come here. And it's worth looking at what brings me here. And it changes over time. It can change. It changes over the years. It changes from week to week. And it changes from moment to moment. So to return to that ethical concern, as the most recent motivation for this talk, I was recently listening to a Dharma talk offered by a longtime Zen practitioner and teacher. And during that talk, the teacher was emphasizing the practice of not following any thought, just letting all thoughts come and go, arise and resolve. And as the talk unfolded, it was clear to me that what was being described was the practice of zazen, or shikantaza, only just sitting, not getting involved, not getting, trying to get a hold of or spin out any of these stories that we have. And as she was saying this, I think there was a reference to it not following thoughts a few times. I noticed that there was no explicit reference to the practice of zazen or shikantaza. That's our style of sitting in this school. She didn't use either of those words. So while listening to the talk and enjoying it and respecting it, in my mind a concern began to arise regarding whether or not others in the room who were listening, who may be new to Zen, were clear about the teaching of the two truths and the difference between Zen and the practice of mere shikantaza. I thought some people might be confused and they might think that the way of Zen and the practice of just sitting are the same, and that there's maybe nothing more to Zen, meaning that simply letting go of all thoughts, letting them come and go, is how a mature Zen practitioner should live in the world. The next morning, I woke up still thinking about this and concerned with whether I, as someone who speaks from the teaching seat, have inadvertently led people to believe that Zen is equivalent to a kind of maybe amoral practice of just sitting. So is Zen, is there a way of inadvertently giving people the impression that this just letting thoughts come and go and sitting is the heart of Zen and it is an amoral practice? Of non-engagement with the arising of thoughts. And as a Zen priest, this is very important to me. I've been living in the East Bay, some of you know, and I recently described in an email message to someone who I'm close to who lives in a less temperate climate, I described the weather that we were having in the East Bay as indistinct to express the how difficult it is often in parts of the Bay Area to distinguish between spring, summer, and fall. So I tell this story because I'm considering it as an illustration of something that I'm talking about. It can be hard to see the differences between the seasons at times. Nevertheless, I think it's our practice to not allow that lack of immediate discernibility to eclipse or negate or obscure what relative kind of verifiable understanding we may have of like where we are in the calendar year or what we know about the effects of global warming or the causes of global warming. The ethical implications of our practice is what I'm considering right now. And ethical considerations require past and future thinking, which is sometimes, it's something that we disengage from during our ritual practice of Zazen. We disengage from past and future thinking. But we can re-engage when we stand up from our sitting practice, and I think that we must re-engage on a bodhisattva path of practice. And as people of vow, those of us who have accepted the bodhisattva vows, many people who come to Zen Center are very drawn to or interested in the practice of shikantaza and the realization of the more profound meaning of zazen. But they are less interested, maybe even much less interested, and maybe even put off by or averse to the onus of the ethical or moral considerations. You know, they want to be free from needing to practice with observing something like precepts. Um, meditation practice and the effects of meditation practice of any kind, including shikantaza, uncoupled from ethical considerations or ethical commitments, are free to be used in so many ways and have been historically. We can use them for good or for ill, or for the benefit, you know, we can use them for the benefit of others, or we can use them merely for our own purposes, our will to concentration. We can use for many purposes. In my mind, this is where Zen differs from mere shikantaza, or our formal practice of just sitting. Zen includes precepts and commitments to offering the fruits of our sitting practice to the welfare of the world. And this means allowing and clarifying and integrating the effects of our sitting practice in ways that inform our discernments, our decision making in our conventional life, in the world of myriad things. Many people in the West don't consider themselves to be religious Zen practitioners, and that is fine. You know, whether Zen is or not, whether or not Zen is a religion is debatable, because it, you know, it is not theistic. But whether or not it's a practice of ethics is not debatable. And I want to be sure that from the Dharma Seed I'm clear in this regard, and that I clearly communicate the importance of the two truths and the 16 Bodhisattva precepts in this tradition. The Zen that I've studied and practiced and experienced is neither amoral nor morally ambiguous. When Suzuki Roshi talked about Zazen, he said Zazen is practicing the precepts. So if we understand Zazen in that way, then we can say, you know, there's no difference between Zen and Zazen, or there is only just Zazen. Suzuki Roshi also referred to Zazen as the only real way of living, which can be hard to comprehend if you're not a Zen practitioner. You come to the Zen Center, as I said recently in a talk at City Center, and you're offered Zazen instruction. And the Zazen instructor never says, Zazen is actually the only real way of living. You know, so there are these almost orders of reality that we need to differentiate between. I'll end with this, another quote from Isho Fujita. Zazen is not self-absorption. Sinking deep into the inner world by shutting oneself off from the outer world. Rather, it is acting to deeply reconnect oneself with the outer world by opening oneself and responding to the world. Actually, it is possible for us to sit upright with proper posture only when we fully receive support from the outside world in what we see, what we hear, the supporting force from the floor, the air coming from outside, etc. So, I welcome conversation. Michael.
Thank you very much for your talk. I was so pleased to hear you bring up ethics. And I think you could throw a rock these days and see the practice of mindfulness has been secularized. but totally divorced of ethics. And so it just warmed my heart so much to hear you bring up the precepts and all of this. I wonder, are you familiar with the writing of, I'm probably going to mispronounce her name, but Liz Bukar, who's a religion professor?
I'm not.
I'll send you her Substack. She kind of talks about a lot of this as well, of how any practice of meditation or mindfulness or zazen or anything simply must include the ethical component in order for it to truly be valid. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kristen, for the talk. As you were describing the subject matter, I kept thinking of the paramitas, because this is a broader system than just shikantaza, and as far as I understand, this is part of our practice, the six paramitas, yes, which includes ethics. But you seem to focus on Zen as being use of the word encompasses not only shikantaza but our ethical responsibilities, and perhaps you're trying to convey something that is a little different than the way, you know, I normally think of this as ethics being, you know, one of six paramitas, which also includes concentration, you know, meditation. So is there a difference?
I don't think so, Larry. I think I just didn't touch on, you know, all of the, we say like the, I was thinking more in terms of precepts. In a way, both the paramitas and the precepts are entirely a system of ethics. But within that system of ethics, we refer specifically to ethical conduct, generosity, patience. But we can say all of those are ethical disciplines. So I was just speaking more generally. I don't think there's any contradiction between.
And your teacher you met in Massachusetts, did he build the lodge with the Okamura Roshi?
He didn't. He was the next wave.
Oh, he was the
next
wave?
Was
he referring to Buddhists in Japan during World War II? Was that what he was,
I can't be sure, but that's where my mind went. And there are many historical and contemporary examples. So,
All right.
It's kind of timeless.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
If I had ever felt that I was being taught that Zazen was training in detachment from the world, I think I would not be here.
Mm-hmm.
And there are just a couple of other aspects that I want to raise to complement the teachings you gave, which I appreciated so much. One is that, for me, this, I'm just speaking about my own kind of spontaneous experience with Zazen. One of the benefits of having regular daily practice just sitting is that it's helped me disidentify with my discursive mind, so that even when I pick it up off the cushion to go about my business in the relative world, I'm not over invested in it, and therefore less prone, not immune to, but less prone to over-intellectualize in ways that lead me astray sometimes in figuring out what an appropriate response is to injustice in the world, to meeting suffering in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And if the teaching of a lifetime is to have an appropriate response, Zazen, I think, helps me with that.
Yes.
By letting me drop all the words.
Yes.
Right? And another thing that happens in Zazen by learning, training myself to not always follow the thoughts, is that I get to have a non-narrated somatic experience of just being alive. And it is inherently about being alive in relation to everything else.
Yes.
And that kind of experience of interdependence, I think, has natural expressions in the world of doing things with the implications for others in mind.
Yes.
Because you're not you know, you're not separate, right? So in that way, I think that shikantaza does directly serve practice of the precepts and ethical conduct in the world, even though we're not practicing with some aim to develop those capacities. It just happens.
I agree. I completely agree. And I think that another thing that shikantaza is very helpful for is it has physiological effects. It really calms the nervous system. It teaches us over time how to kind of shift into more of a parasympathetic, receptive, restorative, restful mode, and we need all of this, and we discover within ourselves this profound resource to be with our lives, to be with what is coming up in here, and to be with what is around us. So I in no way wanted to diminish the importance or the significance of Zazen. It is central to our practice in our tradition because it is so powerful. But in the absence of talking about the ethical implications, you would be surprised by some of the subtle ways one begins to discern that one is that some folks are using this practice in a way to dissociate a little bit from the implications of their way of life. So I bring it in just because for months I've been talking so much about Zazen and the body hanging like a windbell in empty space and the, you know, the lineage of ancestors, and I just haven't really settled on this point for a while, so I wanted to weave it in. Thank you. I see a question in the back.
Todd online,
and then we'll come back to the room.
You can unmute Todd.
Hi, thank you so much for your talk. My question is about not so much ethics, although it's completely inseparable from this, but in response to your statement about the non-separability of the relative and the absolute, it struck me something that I had read by one of Dogen's disciples, Senay, that we're studying along with Daniel and Rosie right now with Mary Mosin. We're studying Genjo Koan. And he said, realization and delusion are not relative to each other and are not two separate things. Delusion is not the opposite of realization. Realization is not the opposite of delusion, which is, I think, exactly what you were saying, just relative to delusion and realization. And yet, for me, in trying to practice with that, I find it locks me up in Zazen. I just get, I stumble around thinking, what am I trying to avoid delusion through realization? You know, and apparently that's what I'm trying to do. I wonder if you have any comment about that, any suggestions?
I mean, mainly great noticing. Not only am I trying to avoid delusion through realization, but am I trying to become a Buddha? Do I have designs on becoming a Buddha? Or which is a line, for those of you who are not familiar, in the Fukan Zazengi. Or am I just this one person, just this? Am I able to be with just this and allow that these teachings to reveal themselves? That teaching of Dogen's is a non-dual teaching, but I think it's a non-dual teaching that doesn't erase the distinction. So that's paradoxical. How do you maintain the distinction and also call the two one? Anyone else in the room?
Yes, Kristen. Glenn. Thank you very much for your talk. I would like to address, why do we come here? Why do we stay? And I came to practice because I had a great deal of mental suffering. I was possessed of, you know, negative ideations that were becoming debilitating, quite frankly. And the process of sitting allowed me to dig through that. And I can't really say that they've vanished entirely, but they do seem to be losing their grip. I would like to say that my teacher at one point said that she was approached to do mindfulness training in a corporate setting and flat out refused to do so because it was divorced from, you know, an ethical component, because it is possible to teach people to do bad things mindfully.
Yes, exactly.
But with the infusion of the precepts, you know, in the sitting practice, I think it, number one, if you observe the precepts, the reason that you might have any kind of negative feeling about yourself or others tends to evaporate. And I believe that if Zazen does have an ultimate goal, it will give me the ability to respond to any given situation in a way that is beneficial to the, you know, in the broadest sense that I'm capable of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, both to others as well as myself.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I think it's generally questionable to think that things vanish never to return. We are just better equipped to meet them when they do, you know, with compassion, with wisdom, with some sense of spaciousness, to not be overwhelmed by them, and not only to meet our own difficulties, but to meet others. The better able we are to meet ourselves, the better able we are to meet and be with in an intimate way, patiently, generously, with others.
Thank you for your talk, Kristen.
You're welcome.
I think the thing that's kept me practicing and interested in studying the precepts and interested in sitting is kind of what everybody's saying, but in a very gentle way. This has been the softest, gentlest for me to live a Zen life. Do you see what I mean? It's just been very different than any other religion that I have studied. And I know that there's a lot of the words no and the chanting, but we know the magic that, you know, that happens with that. So it's just very gentle. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, as always, thank you for your talk, and yeah, I really appreciated it because when you presented the one truth and the two truths, and maybe there is a third truth, and are you going to treat it as some subset of a truth? And I don't know, I started to do a catalog through Suzuki Roshi's writings and recall him talking about the re and g,
yes,
and branching streams and all of that, and it's very dominant. But a lot of, in my experience, what I come from with Shikantaza or Zazen, it's not really learned intellectually, but through the bones at the end of the day. And so in branching streams, one day I just read, you know, when you sit Zazen, the entire universe sits with you. And I was like, you know, I can't articulate what that means, perhaps, but I get it.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I thought of, too, is going right back to beginner's mind. And it's probably right at the beginning of the book, almost. It's not one, not two. It's one and two. And that's almost...
three.
The truth in
that's
itself.
One and two is three.
Don't go down that road.
Yeah, so the re and g, you know, you sit zazen and the universe sits with you is the re and g. And what the translation that I recall of re and g is like self-power or other power, you know, both right there. You bring yourself to the seat and then the entire universe, including you, sits zazen. Suzuki Roshi said, don't say you sit zazen. Zazen sits zazen.
I'm in another Dharma group, and one person in the group's practice, as we talk about our subject matter, which is the Dharma, is to almost every time we meet to bring up how that teaching would be heard by an immigrant in detention. And this always creates a kind of silence, you know, in the group, because we were there to talk about we were there to talk about this text and this sutra, and it seems to throw some cognitive dissonance into the into what we're doing, and we kind of all struggle with it because we think that what we're doing is studying the Dharma, and we think we can set aside the immigrants in detention for that time. But one person insists that we can't. I appreciate the first quote from your
Isho Fujita.
Isho Fujita was wonderful. You know, I think he really hit something there. There's just, to me, sometimes though, I think that when we let the Dharma be the Dharma, and we let the relative world be the relative world for just a time, you know, that's kind of a helpful discussion. We don't have to forget about the relative world,
What do you mean, Jim, by the Dharma? Because it has many meanings.
Well, it's like the thing I would always object to in discourse. You know, you're having a discourse with somebody about something, and you know, it's about life or it's about politics or whatever, and then, you know, in the midst of that, somebody interjects, you know, some wisdom teaching.
Seems unfair.
It seems. I don't know. It may be unfair is the right word, but. So I'm not really, you know, at all objecting to any the perspective that you've brought at all. I'm just saying that when we see if we have to be careful on the Dharma seat, you know, about how much we and you know, people in the pulpit and so forth, where they go with. I mean, in our society, people, in some instances, you know, really tell people how to vote and from the pulpit and so forth. You know, this happens, and I think we would definitely draw the line in our practice at that kind of activity. So it's just something I think we have the mixing of I know I have brought up in talks my angst about things in society. So it's just something that that we have to be mindful about.
And I think sanghas in particular should go on having conversations about this topic, because when this kind of question comes up, it's curious to me, because what I've been talking about the relative tonight is the precepts, which are the Dharma. And yet it brings up these other associations, and I know that tricky situations can arise. Like, a lot of things get conflated, and sometimes there's a wish, can we just focus on this for now and talk about this, and just bracket some of these other things, and then have another conversation in which maybe we try to integrate or widen the aperture. And so I think we need to practice with each other, kind of focusing, widening the aperture, integrating, and that takes time, like relationship over time. Sometimes people bring it up immediately because there's suddenly a lack of trust, like, am I safe here? Maybe maybe I'm an immigrant, or someone in my family is here in some tenuous set of circumstances, and people are talking so glibly about something, and I have to bring it up because suddenly I feel like this doesn't feel safe to me. There seems to be like some real gap between what's being talked about here and the world that I find myself living in. So it can be complicated, but I do think it's worth, we need to keep turning it together as a sangha over time. Thank you.
Thank you. I just wanted to add that in response, you invited other responses to how Za and Zen are related. And I thought practice realization maps quite nicely onto Za Zen.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Just briefly, last week we had a wonderful talk by Sarah Tasker. If you see her, please tell her I think it's a wonderful talk. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that came to mind was her wonderful gesture regarding this discussion, as I understand, about how we live up here and we also live down here all the time simultaneously. The two truths, the one truth and the two truths, they're all happening all the time together. Mm-hmm. Not even together, It's the third truth.
Thank you. I will let her know.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kristen. I really
You're
enjoyed
welcome.
Your talk.
Thank you.
So when you talked about why you come here, or why people come here, and I asked myself that, and I thought, well, maybe way back when I first started meditating, it was to escape some suffering. But since coming to Valley Streams, I feel so connected. I'm not at all trying to escape anything. In fact, when I come here, I'm more connected to the world. So it's like I come here to get connected, yeah, and not escape. And it's because I feel so connected to my sangha that I'm able to take that with me back to my house. So that was a really nice question to ask myself, and I didn't see that coming.
Mm.
But that's why I keep coming here, because I want the truth. And I get little tiny glimpses of it when I come here. And that's why I'm here.
So. Thank you so much. That's wonderful.